This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'd like you to take a moment to think about what makes you smile. You smile when you're happy, sure, and you smile when someone is taking your picture. Do you smile automatically throughout the day when you make eye contact with other people or when you're in conversation? Perhaps smiling is not a straightforward expression of happiness. Do you smile when you're sad or when you're angry? This hour, we will talk about when we smile and why we smile. Marianne LaFrance is a professor of psychology at Yale University and the author of Why Smile, The Science Behind Facial Expressions. Marianne LaFrance, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
How did you become interested in smiling?
Became interested before smiling in particular in this general area called nonverbal communication, which is the study of all the ways that we impact each other through our bodies, through our faces, through our voices, through our gestures, through how we adopt various positions, through touch, through many kind of channels. But the basic notion is that we are often affected by what other people do with their bodies and faces. And then as I got into that field a little bit more, then the smile popped out as something that people actually both thought was so simple it didn't need addressing at all. It was uninteresting. Or it was something that was so natural as, again, it didn't need any attention by psychologists or social scientists. But authors, artists of various kinds over the years have clearly pointed out that the smile is anything but simple and anything but automatic and straightforward. So that's what started us, and that was a number of years ago that we went into the lab with the question.
Well, there's something in what you just said, something about it being so biological. How biological is the smile?
Well, it's clear that babies smile in the womb. So if you want to signal that it's something that we humans come prepared with, the smile is it. Babies in their final trimester show all kinds of smiles in the womb. So that's not to say that they're happy as little clams in the womb. We don't know that.
That's just gas. I'm sorry.
Actually, there are data on that show that it's not gas. That is one of those truisms about smiling, which psychologists who study babies have totally disproved. The issue is that babies come to birth ready to smile because their survival may depend upon it. Babies need to have the love and care of attentive adults, and there is nothing more seductive and more relationship cementing than a baby's smile. Caregivers are done for once they see a baby smile.
So there you go. So there is something adaptive about a smile. It's part of the reason we're still here. If you're going to be successful, you better know how to do that. When did science start paying attention to smiling?
Well, it's been around for a while. Darwin, in 1872, in his book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, talked about smiling. But actually, he, if truth, threw up his hands and said he didn't quite know what the smile was all about. The other expressions, anger, sadness, and the like, he thought, okay, this makes sense. This is functional. But smiling, why are people smiling? At the same time, a French physiologist by the name of Duchenne started to put electrodes and electricity into people's faces and to fire up certain muscles. Theoretically, it wasn't painful to the person who he did this to. And he noticed that there was a smile that looked real and genuine and pleased, and another smile that didn't seem to have any of those genuine qualities to it. So he began with the notion that different muscles reflected different smiles, and different smiles came from different psychological and emotional states.
And that gets us to why the smile is inscrutable and difficult to describe or understand. It would be simple enough to say we smile when we're happy. We smile to elicit a good response to someone else, as babies do. It's because we don't always. It's because smiles can conceal as much as they reveal. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And that is the challenge of smiling. They both convey something true because we do smile when we're happy. But it's also true that most of the smiles you see in the course of a day, most of the smiles that you both see and emit and others see are not, quote, genuine smiles. That does not mean that we're all fakes. Well, actually, it may. But what it does indicate is that there are two different brain systems involved in smiling, an intentional system and an automatic system. And they function differently. They serve different social needs and psychological aspects.
But all of that, it seems to me, is somehow affected by culture, because we know there are people who simply won't crack a smile. You would think something has just made them happy, and there may be something about their upbringing that, you know, they've been told not to show their emotions, and so they suppress what would be this natural or automatic smile, right?
Well, the thing that pointing out the culture aspect is one of those really wonderfully rich ideas that has caught the attention of a lot of psychologists, namely that, yes, we all come to birth with the ability to smile, including babies that are born blind and born deaf. So we have this capacity to smile, but then it gets layered over with all kinds of both individual experience. So an individual may learn that it's never, never appropriate to express anger. So they, right from day one, get the message, smile. If you're feeling angry, smile. If you're feeling angry, smile. So whenever they feel angry, they smile. But then there are all the cultural levels. So we know that Japanese moms, for example, want to see their babies looking content, whereas American moms want to see their babies looking enthused and active and engaged. So the rules about smiling have to do with what the culture regards as appropriate behavior. So Americans smiling in the other parts of the world is regarded as promiscuous. People all over the world always are asking, why does Americans smile so much? It's not because Americans are significantly more happy than many other people. It is the fact that the American way of engaging the world is to be very sociable, whereas in other parts of the world, in fact, a study that was just done in which pictures were taken off Facebook sites in the old East Bloc countries in Europe and Western Europe, and those in Western Europe smile significantly more than those in the East Bloc countries. So there are regional differences. In North Carolina, people smile much more than where I am in New England. So the layers of what the rules are for who smiles when, how much, and what it means are actually fairly complicated.
We talk about this business of sort of natural smiles or automatic smiles and smiles that we kind of force, and we know about that. How good are we at detecting the difference? Does it matter to us that the smile is forced or not genuine?
It matters in the sense that if you can detect a genuine smile from a posed or social smile, it will matter a lot in terms of how you're going to interpret what you see. So we are able to do it, but we don't often do it. That is to say that one of the things we know is that people don't pay that close attention to each other's faces. In fact, we tend to give each other some room to do what they want to do with their face most of the time. So it matters to know whether it's a genuine smile or not, but it doesn't necessarily mean because we can do it that we do it.
And you talked about the training you can have, the cultural training, which suggests at some level that we adopt these practices and behaviors without really being conscious of them. When do we actually start becoming conscious of our own smiling?
I actually think that we're not very conscious. I think, for example, the data show that if you ask people how much they smile in the course of a day, most people over-report how much they smile. So most people say, I'm a happy person, I'm a generally pleasant person, I must be smiling all the time. But because they know the rule that smiles indicate pleasantness and affability doesn't necessarily mean that they follow it up with what's actually on their faces. We clearly practice smiles. There's probably not a single person who hasn't stood in front of a mirror and tried to move their face into something resembling a stunning smile. We also know that some of us know that we look terrible when we smile. We look at all those class pictures and yearbook photographs and Christmas celebrations, and we think, oh, God, that's terrible. I wish I didn't look like that. So we are conscious sometimes, but more often than not, other people's smiles impact us without us knowing that it is the smile that has impacted us.
How much of what we do when we smile is a reflection of how we feel, and how much of it is an attempt to manipulate or sort of get somebody else, to get a reaction from somebody else?
It's It's actually fairly complicated because we smile a lot of the times to affect some outcome without necessarily doing it in a manipulative way. So I catch you across the room at a social event. We both flash a smile at each other. That's not necessarily because we're happy to see each other, although I, of course, would be happy to see you, but basically, it's an automatic response that people who know each other do to acknowledge each other's presence. In fact, if I didn't smile and we did know each other and you smiled at me from across the room, you would take very strong note of the fact that I didn't smile and wonder what's going on. Was I angry at you? Was I trying to send you a message? Did you just say something really stupid? So, because a smile is automatic doesn't necessarily mean that it's genuine. It can be well learned and hence automatic without it necessarily reflecting truly positive feelings.
Mary Ann LaFrance, a professor of psychology at Yale University and the author of Why Smile? The Science Behind Facial Expressions. Our conversation about smiles continues on the state of things, and we'll see how that changes along cultural and gender lines when our program continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.
If you smile at me, I will understand, 'cause that is something everybody everywhere does in the same language. I can see by your coat, my friend, you're from the other side.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and we're devoting this hour to smiles. Mary Ann LaFrance is a professor of psychology at Yale University and the author of Why Smile? The Science Behind Facial Expressions. And joining us now is Priscilla Wald. She's a professor of English and Women's Studies at Duke University. Priscilla Wald, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, thank you.
I want to pose another question to Mary Ann. Mary Ann, scientists use the facial action coding system. They were using that, and they tried to decode the Mona Lisa smile. And tell us about that and what they found.
The interesting thing about anybody's face, including the so-called Mona Lisa, is that we have many muscles on our faces. So when we're asking about what is a true smile, we're asking what is going on in the face besides the outer corners of the mouth heading up in an oblique kind of angle. So what's going on in the eyes, what's going on in the forehead, what's going on in the cheeks, in the chin, and so on. All of that forms a single package. So what we learned from looking at the Mona Lisa smile is that there is a smile component there. That is, there's a very slight movement or assumed movement of the lip corners. But when we also look at our eyes, we see some, well, maybe anger. If we look at the forehead, we see some maybe disgust. So each muscle on the face has its own set of messages, and when they form together, there is a unitary kind of package. Nonetheless, it's possible to deconstruct or decompose anybody's smile and say how much is happy, how much of it might be actually a cover for sadness, in which the sadness is seeping through, how much of it might be a cover for anger, in which case maybe the lips are lengthening and tightening a little bit. So even though the lips are turning up, that looks like a smile, there's a tightness that suggests some anger as well.
Priscilla, why do you think that the Mona Lisa smile has fascinated us so?
And I found that really interesting. Marianne, I really enjoyed your book. And I saw the statistics. It was 83% happy, 90% disgusted, 6% fearful, and 2% angry. And I was really intrigued by that. But I thought, from my point of view, what about mystery? And obviously, that's not something that we can characterize in the same way that we can characterize happiness or anger or fearfulness. But the Mona Lisa has attracted viewers and critics and appears in literature all the time for its air of mystery and intrigue, and she knows something and she's enticing us in some way. And those are the intangibles that I was wondering about. Where, how do we measure those? Where do they factor into the Ekman, the FACS scale that you talk about? How do we understand that ineffable aspect that is so intriguing to us about the Mona Lisa?
Uh-huh. I think there are two things that I, as a social scientist, would say. There is mystery, to be sure. What I would say is part of the mystery is this combination of sadness and anger and happiness. And most of us don't have the words for combinations of things that we see in somebody's expression. So what we often say is mysterious is that we can't find a verbal label that or labels that best describe this array of things that are going on. So our faces are this incredible complex configuration, and it's not one thing. And that's in part, I think, where the mystery comes from.
And it seems to me, let me pose this to both of you. The idea of mystery, even in the Mona Lisa, a question you could ask is, does she mean to be mysterious? In other words, does she know something we don't? Or is there something that she doesn't know about herself, a kind of anguish that she hasn't revealed to herself? And so it seems to me this is sort of part of game theory. What do I know? What don't I know? And, you know, what do they know I know about them, right? And isn't that what's important about reading faces, right?
Then there's the artist, right? We're talking about the Mona Lisa,
right.
But there's an artist behind the Mona Lisa that's somehow capturing something. And Marianne, you said earlier you were so interested, and I love this about your book, how much literature there is there. You were interested in the fiction writers and the poets, and we can add the mm-hmm. painters and the sculptors and the filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at the world. And what's so wonderful about art and magical is that it captures something that we don't necessarily consciously see about ourselves in the day-to-day, right? They are the ones that have heightened attention.
Yeah.
And so there's also the artist's vision that's capturing something about the Mona Lisa. He's the one who gave her that smile and found
there's one
that
other,
smile.
There's one other aspect that we should add to this equation, which is the perceiver. So mm-hmm. some of us look at the Mona Lisa and go, what's the big deal? And others say, wow, that is really so freaking ambiguous and wonderfully enticing, and what is going on? So one of the things that's really interesting about the smile is you could say, we can deconstruct it, we can see what its components are, but a really important part of it is who's watching, who's looking in, who's interpreting. What issues does the observer have in reading an expression? Are they inclined to be the suspicious, paranoid type who see in a smile some cover-up? Or are they the affable, generous who only see goodness? And part of what's going on in interaction is sorting out what's on the face, but also what's in the eyes of the people who are beholding the face.
And you have to know a lot about their expectations as well, and cultural expectations play a big part in this. So that gets us to gender and gender expectations. Marianne, I understand that you ask your undergraduate students if they've ever been asked on the street, you know, why don't you smile, by a stranger? And what kind of response did you get?
There's hardly a woman alive who hasn't been told by a stranger in some public setting to smile, to give us a smile. Oh, come on, show us a smile. Why are you so glum? Why don't you look more happy? There's not a man practically alive who's had another man, stranger, on the street say that to him. So there's something really fascinating about the fact that, one, women are expected to smile, that it's legitimate, I put that word in quotes here, for a stranger to tell a woman what to do with her face. And part of that is the fact that we expect women to smile, and we want to see a smile, and we feel better when we see a smile. We don't particularly care if she's happy. Mm-hmm. We feel better when we see it.
Well, Priscilla, what do you make of that? I know that quantitatively there is some research that suggests that women smile more than men. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, do you accept that research? And then, Priscilla, what would you make of that?
I do accept that research, and I definitely think we have gender roles and certain aspects that get assigned to each of us according to our gender roles and certain expectations according to our gender roles, both male and female. At the same time, I was really interested to read in the book, Marianne, that stay-at-home fathers smiled as much as stay-at-home mothers. So the right. role of caretaking involves smiling. And right. as gender roles are changing, I imagine that these gender expectations, well, obviously, from what you say, these gender expectations are changing along with them. And I'm totally intrigued by that. Gender expectations are no more static than right. gender is, right? And gender's changing. The expectations right. about gender are changing. That's wonderful. That's really interesting. And
absolutely.
Exciting.
It's a dynamic process. Excuse me. We know from studies that we've done looking at college yearbooks, for example, that over time, the number of men who are smiling in their college yearbooks has gone up, and the amount of smiling for women has actually gone down somewhat. So one of the things that's interesting about gender is that it's not fixed. It is a dynamic system, and what constitutes appropriate gendered behavior changes historically, changes culturally, changes in terms of developmental stage. We know, for example, that the largest difference between the sexes and how much women and men smile, that is with women smiling more than men, occurs at the ages between the ages of about 17 and 29. Why? Well, that's the big dating point. That's the big mating point. That's the time when people need to identify each other as potential mates. It's also maybe a power issue that's going on at the same time. That's when men tend to be exerting more power than women in terms of relationships. So gender is wrapped up as well in terms of social occupations, as you've noted. So if it used to be thought that women smile more, and that's why they're naturally good at being nurses or primary school teachers or caregivers of various kinds. But as men move into those occupations, lo and behold, they smile as much as women do. So it's not something that women do. It's something that people in caregiving occupations do. And if men are in those occupations, then they tend to do more of what previously was thought to be a female thing.
Well, it's interesting to think. I wanted to get to this literary reference, too, because I thought it was telling in your book, among the many in your book, Marianne, Why Smile, the Henry James quote from Portrait of a Lady.
Right.
If I may read it here. She shook hands with Lord Warburton and stood looking up into his face with a fixed smile, a smile that Isabel knew, though his lordship probably never suspected it, to be near akin to a burst of tears.
Mm-hmm.
Do we expect women to be better readers of facial expressions as well?
We do expect it, and we want to have it. We want to see that women are appropriately sensitive and attentive and taking into account what our feelings are. One of the major gender roles is that women should be the emotional experts. We allow women that role because every relationship needs a relationship expert, and better that it be assigned ahead of time to women in that position. One of the other quotes, if I can refer to, that I think is interesting, also a Henry James quote, is that I think it was from Wings of the Dove, where the character says, or when James says, when Millie smiled, it was a public event. When she didn't, it was a chapter of history. The point there is that smiles are public. They're there to be seen. They're there to be noted. But the expectation is so high that women smile more that when they don't, it becomes a chapter in history. We notice the absence of smiling on women, and we tend to notice a man who smiles a lot. That's a chapter in history as well.
So, Priscilla, have we then assigned smiling as a sort of a feminine trait? It's a mark of femininity?
I think it depends on the smile. I mean, interestingly, mm-hmm. when I was first asked about this and Sean asked me, well, what do you think of when you think of a smile in literature? And, you know, this may be revealing more about myself, but I thought, oh, the leer. You know, the leer is one of the most common forms of smiling. Women leer when they're, for instance, Women of the Night, and I think of Hawthorne's short story, My Kinsman Major Molyneux. There are women leering out of windows, and the young male who has just come from the into town from the country is very nonplussed by that. But mostly it's rakes. It's men who are exerting their mm-hmm. power over women who leer. So, you know, I don't think these are entirely gendered, but they tend to shift one way or another. And as you note, they can be a range of smiles. But I also want to go back, in light of the literary examples you gave too, to your example, which I have experienced, of people telling me to smile on the street. Sometimes those smiles are solicitous and caring. Sometimes somebody, a man or a woman, but it's usually a man, you're right, is saying, you know, why aren't you happy? And in some occasions, and I agree, not most of them, but in some occasions, it really is a caring comment. And I find that very interesting because, again, I think men may feel more comfortable being nurturing towards women. I do hope all of this is changing. I hope that these range of emotions and roles are increasingly, we realize, open to all of us. But I've had the experience of somebody being very kind on the street when I've been looking sad and really honestly trying to cheer me up.
But it is interesting that a man would never do that. Well, we can't imagine a man taking liberty to with another man and yet feels the right. Right, the permission to do that when it's a woman.
Although I wonder if that crosses over with sexuality. I wonder if in a neighborhood, you know, that's known more as a gay neighborhood, if a man might more comfortably say to another man, "Hey, what's the matter? Smile." You know, I wonder if the gender roles are more rigid along sexual lines. And again, I wonder, I do hope and think that it's opening up all for all of us.
Well, Marianne, you also did a test that, again, points to this business of expectations when you did some quick identifications, man, woman, and you had what? They were women with smiles but angry eyes and sort of the combinations that suggested, maybe you can tell us about that test, that suggested that we are sort of prejudiced into believing that men tend to smile less and women smile more. Tell us about that test.
Well, there's several interesting things about that. Again, as noted earlier, the face is capable of showing an array of emotions simultaneously. So there are things like miserable smiles. There are angry smiles. There are, as Priscilla mentioned, there are leering smiles. There are wolfish smiles. There are really sad smiles. So the face is this complex array. And if we're just catching what the mouth corners are doing, we say, okay, it's a smile. But if we're actually paying closer attention, we may see that there are other things going on there. We may see that some sadness has been covered up with a smile that is not felt, but it is there to mask the fact that one's paying attention. Women tend to be more attentive to mixed signals. Men, alas, tend to be less attentive to nonverbal cues in general and to facial cues in particular. So, for example, if you present stimuli, that's a scientific term for what faces. If you present pictures of people, women, smiling a little bit, and you say to a man, what's going on here? What do you think she's feeling? What do you think she's doing? The vast majority of men see it as likely flirtatious. If you show women the same expression on a man's face or the same expression on a woman's face and say, what do you think's going on here? Women are more likely to say, well, she could be feeling nervous and she's trying not to show it. She could be showing that she's friendly and wants to have a conversation. She could be really coming on to someone. In short, women allow for the possibility of many more possibilities than men do, which is in itself interesting because, again, depends on the perceiver and what they make of what they see.
Well, and I want to pursue this business of the power relationships. If it's a leer, it's really a very intentional, constructed kind of a smile, isn't it? I mean, it appears to be deliberate versus the relaxed eye, actual genuine smile, which conveys a bit of vulnerability. So those are two kind of very different power relationships or power messages, I guess, that one would convey with the same, you know, with the same feature, a smile, right?
Right. Power is a wonderful dynamic to try to integrate with understanding smile. And most people would think of smile as having nothing to do with power. Smiling, after all, is innocent and simple and straightforward. It means that people are happy or pleased or amused or contented or something like that. What we do know from power relationships, however, is that it generally behooves the lower power person in a relationship or in a company structure to be the one to smile more than the person with power.
Even when it's a forced smile, it's fascinating to me the photo in your book of the Pullman porter, African American,
yes,
with a very, very deliberate forced smile. And yet you can imagine in the power relationship for those who are the dominant, right? So for if I'm in the dominant position, knowing that you hate this and that you're forced to smile makes the power relationship all that more exquisite, makes the smile.
Exactly. Even though, I think your observation is right on target there, because I can see someone, for example, I occasionally have students who come and they want something from me, an extension, they want an override, they want something. Perhaps their paper is late or something more, malfeasance has occurred.
Yeah.
And they want my good graces. They want me to be lenient on them, and they will smile. Are they smiling because they're happy? No. I mean, they know it. I know it. We all recognize the game. If they don't smile, I might actually think less of them because I want to see some indications that they're in the social order, that they recognize that there is this power thing and I've got it and they don't at the moment. And they need to show me that they're basically good at heart. And smiling is one of the ways that's done.
We're going to continue our conversation about smiling today on The State of Things with Marianne LaFrance, professor of psychology at Yale and the author of Why Smile? The Science Behind Facial Expressions, and Priscilla Walder, professor of English and Women's Studies at Duke University. And when we continue, we'll look at why athletes look more angry than happy at that most exquisite moment for them in sports. What's going on? Find out more on The State of Things when our program continues. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about smiles this hour. Marianne LaFrance is a professor of psychology at Yale University and the author of Why Smile? The Science Behind Facial Expressions. Priscilla Wald is a professor of English and Women's Studies at Duke University. And now we want to turn our attention to smiles in the world of pro sports. Joining us now is Dave McKenna. He's a writer based in Washington, D.C., and he recently wrote an article in Slate called The End of Joy: Why Do Athletes Look So Angry When They Do Something Great? Dave, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Talk about the genesis of this piece. LeBron James, the end of Game 1, Eastern Conference Finals. Paint the picture.
Well, I had seen LeBron James play in high school, and he walked past me, and you could tell that he was a special guy. Like, you could tell at an early age, he's just a special person. He's this physically huge person who seemingly walked on air. And he's gone on as in the years that, you know, it was 14 years. It was a long time ago. I don't know how many. Can't do the math. 13 years ago or something. He's gone on to prove that he's a very special person. He can do athletically. He can do what any athlete would ever want to do. He has all the gifts and all those gifts. He's also a very smart basketball player. And all his special gifts came together at the end of this game in Indiana. The first that I wrote about, the first game of the NBA Eastern Conference Championship, where he got the ball with like one and a half seconds left at the top of the key, and just where most people would just pull up and throw up a prayer. He decided that he was going to bolt to the basket, and even this huge guy, and he had all the athletic gifts, like I said, to do this, to go from the top of the key, to make this, and to surprise everybody and run to the basket and make this incredible layup. And it was just like an amazing, everything came together, and it won the game. The buzzer is off, the game's over, and he at this incredible moment, he just scowled. He like put his, you know, in a, like a Kimbo stance and akimbo and scowled at the crowd, and it made me very sad. You know, I'm from the if you're happy and you know it, your face should really show it. And he's generation, and he didn't. It like, why would you be mad when you've done? Yeah. You're so you're so gifted and you've done something so marvelous.
It's possible, Dave, that he was just mad that the Heat should never have been that close at the end of that game.
well, the thing that really struck me was the only, on the TV shot, you can look it up, the only person on the court smiling was Roy Hibbert, a loser on the bench. Yeah. And like his LeBron's teammates are also enraged that they've had such good fortune.
When you point out that this is not just LeBron, that there's a kind of growing phenomenon, a kind of culture of rage among winning athletes.
It's come on. Well, and the Hibbert thing, like I guess smiling is for losers has been the message for some time. Glee is, you know, a show for soft people. Glee is a word. Glee is soft, and soft is a word that you you don't want to be labeled like that's the it's a leper. You'd rather be called a leper in sports than soft.
Well, Priscilla Wald, what do you make of this? I mean, if it's really happening, is this kind of sort of masculine hyperdrive to really prove our masculinity? We're not even going to be happy at the good moments.
Well, the question I'm wondering is it more that he didn't want to gloat? I mean, smiling for a winner to smile could be read as impolite, right, towards the loser. And I'm just wondering, you call it rage. I didn't see the picture, so I don't know. But is that possible,
Dave?
No, not in this case. No, I don't think so. I think it's a pose because, like, I don't think. And you people are smarter than me, but I don't think that suppressing joy is innate. I mean, when my 3-year-old dunks a basketball on our Fisher Price hoop, you know, he's won the lottery. So I don't know why LeBron, you know, you would want that. That's what I would want out of these adult athletes. Also, it is not that they don't worry about gloating. No, if they thought gloating was in vogue, they would gloat.
Yeah, it is, and I've seen some of these pictures, and it really is a kind of. It is a sort of rage. It's almost like looking at the audience saying, you know, now what do you so now what? Now what? Right?
And it's
almost
same,
like a challenge.
It's in football. It's just hilarious. I mean, like when I was a kid or younger, anyway, the team I followed with the Washington Redskins had a touchdown celebration called the Fun Bunch, where the guys got together after every score. The offensive unit would get together in the end zone and jump up in the air, and it was really goofy, but it was fun. But the NFL outlawed that, and over time, the celebrations we have now are these, you know, again. These exhibitions of rage where the players try to spike the football like they're trying to hurt it.
Yeah. Or violent collisions with members of their own team.
Oh, their own, exactly. The helmet-to-helmet contact. Yeah. Or the kickers is the one that really is funny. Like they kick and Tim Tebow, the devoutest player out there. He'd have some joy, the joyful spirit, and when he scores, it's like, you know, he points toward the heavens with this rage look, like, you know, God didn't pay the rent this month or something.
I'm wondering then. I mean, my other question would be, again, I'd love to see the picture, but my question would then be, is this compensation? Marianne talked about how men are beginning to smile more and women are beginning to smile less. Is it an overcompensation?
Well, Marianne?
Let's keep our masculinity.
Yeah, that's what Marianne, what do you think?
Well, I think the word of the moment is the really key one, which is it's a pose. So I'm now going to go back and look at LeBron and see what's going on there and deconstruct what's going on in the face. My sense is that it's not rage. It is a matter of I am about business here. I am really good at what I do, and what I do is professional. It has nothing to do with fun. It has nothing to do with being boyish or charming. It has nothing to do with being a kid. God forbid I should show, in fact, joy in circumstances, because I'm taking this very seriously. And when he looks at the crowd with a scowl on his face, he's also saying, you take me seriously, because I'm not just in this for the game. So my guess is that, like a lot of facial expressions and a lot of smiles, there are poses. We know, for example, that men, if you show them really male undergraduates, if you can call them men, but enough for that, if you show male undergraduates really disgusting kind of scenes, they will smile, whereas girls will look squeamish and disgusted by the thing. So all of these are ways that we learn to reflect and convey a sense of who we are and how we want to be taken. So it's less about what we're really feeling than this is what I want you to think of me.
Well, and the pose is constructed around those expectations, because if it was just, hey, I'm all about the business, you would simply drop your shoulders and walk to the locker room. But the idea that you're going to now look angry when you expect it, and how much do you think this is the case? You're expecting me to jump for joy, pump, you know, fist pump the air and have a broad smile on my face. Watch this. I'm going the other way. So to some extent, knowing, having the expectation of a smile is what makes that pose particularly perhaps more trenchant. I mean, that's a guess. What do you think?
You're absolutely right. I mean,
Well, go ahead, Marianne, then I'll go to you, Dave. How about that?
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the expectation is that when, because most of us, when we play basketball or baseball or whatever, and we score a run or do something good, we're still kids. And when we're kids, our natural emotions rush to the surface. But part of becoming an adult is learning how to fake it and learning how to convey a sense of what we want to be seen as. So LeBron is being observed. There is a huge audience there, both literally there and in all the ESPN, YouTube, et cetera, videos that will go on forever. So it is to be seen. He knows that he's being watched, and he's trying to convey a sense of who he is at that moment. And it's not about being a kid. It's not about just being happy that he gets to be on the court.
Yeah. Dave, what, Dave?
Well, I was going to say a couple things. One of the reasons that I assume that it is a pose with LeBron is because earlier in his career, we've seen, you know, him smile. We've seen him that's part of the tragedy to me, is that he has an amazing smile. It's as broad as his shoulders. He's got this big face. He's just everyone who watches basketball, you have to like just be in awe of watching this guy. He's just such a package. But we know that he has it in him, so he's suppressing it, and for marketing purposes.
About his career. I mean, we should point this out, right, Dave? I mean, he didn't go to college. He came right out of high school, and the criticism was, you know, he's too young. He's a kid. He's not right for this league. There's men. He's a boy among men. So that was one of the raps on him when he started. Then he couldn't win a championship when he was in Cleveland, so the fans are on him. He's all this greatness, but he can't win the big one. So yeah, turning to the fans and saying, how about that, folks? You know, might just be what he was trying to say. If you look at the sort of the grand theater, given his particular career and the expectations people have.
But that makes sense. But I'm going to go to what Dave was saying and say, you know, Dave, you said that's tragic. I mean, I think it's really sad, not so much in his one case, because that is an explanation, but it's really sad if we lose our sense of play, not just on the courts, but everywhere. I think a sense of play and more smiling, maybe I'm revealing myself as an American here, could make us all more social, could make us all able to manage conflict better. You know, sense of play is just the most wonderful thing possible. I bring it, I hope, to all of my classes and everything I do. And I hate the thought that we're going to lose our sense of play.
Dave?
Well, the thrill, I mean, I think that what's wrong with the thrill of victory? It shouldn't be the agony of victory. It should be the thrill.
Right.
And we watch sports for catharsis as a fan, you know, and watching somebody like LeBron, when he does something amazing, watching him celebrate with amazing joy, I think would be far healthier for society than watching him enraged.
Well, and you also wrote about the time when that moment when he did smile, and it was a fan making a hook shot from half court, right? Tell us that
exactly.
Story.
He let his guard down during a timeout. He was sitting. It was at a Miami game, a Heat game, and one of those wacky promotions that you're burdened with if you go to a pro sports event. Or during a timeout, they're having a giveaway of $75,000, I believe it was, for if a random fan hit a hook shot or hit a half court shot, and he hit it like he was this goofy guy, and he threw it up there, and it went in, and out of nowhere, like you see. This is at half court, and this is during a timeout when ostensibly the coach of the Heat was dispensing X's and O's kind of information vital to winning the game. And out of nowhere, LeBron comes into the shot and into the screen and tackles the guy, and they're rolling him and this fat guy rolling around at half court. I mean, it was an amazing
laughing and like, smiling. He didn't tackle him, hurt him, right?
Oh, yeah, no, he tackled him. He was so happy for the guy, and it was an amazing. It was such a happy moment, and watching that is again made me far happier than watching. watching. I would rather watch that clip 100 times than watch him hit the shot against Indiana and scowl.
But it's perverse. Go ahead, Priscilla.
No, that's so important what you're saying there, because it's better for all of us. Listen to what you just said. You were so happy watching that moment. Mm-hmm. Isn't that better for all of us? How do we get our sense of playback?
Yeah, and the note, and when we smile, I mean, it really does recognize these liminal moments when all of our expectations have changed. So we thought things were going to go this way, and they went that way. And those, mm-hmm. it's precisely those liminal moments where the grace happens, where the unexpected and the opportunity really arises.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So making the it does remind me, though, having him smile at that moment and not at the championship game or in the playoffs. You know, Mozart, who did not get along well with his father, writes this very long letter to a friend 3 days after his father died. And it goes on and on about Mozart's cat. And the cat died, and Mozart was distraught. And there's like 9 pages about the dead cat. And incidentally, in the course of this letter, he mentions, oh, by the way, 3 days ago, my father died. And it does suggest a kind of displaced, joy when you tackle a fat guy at the half-court shot and can't really celebrate your victory in the playoffs. So we're. Go ahead.
No, I think Priscilla's comment is really interesting here in terms of do we forget? Have we lost joy? One of the things that, as a psychologist, I'm really interested in is that the thing that happens to little boys beginning about age 3 and usually in place by age 5 is not only that big boys don't cry, but big boys don't smile. Because to show anything on your face may give you away. So a lot of work goes into suppressing any kind of display of emotion, whether it's sadness or happiness. And what we know from the research that shows that emotion travels in both directions, both it comes out, but it also, if we suppress, if our faces are in constant dour mode, neutral mode, we may in fact be squelching our emotional lives at the same time.
Isn't there a price to pay for that? And wouldn't that trump the kind of training that you got? I mean, if you're trained to do something in a certain way and it doesn't really pay off for you, don't you, a generation or two, stop giving that advice?
I hope
yes.
But apparently not. I mean, you know, boys have been told to not show their emotions for generations now. Isn't there a price to pay?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, in fact, if we could devote probably many hours to discussion of this, there is a price to pay. Emotionally, there is a price to pay when the assumption is that emotional life is something to be trimmed, to be reduced, to be inhibited because of fear that we might be able to be read by other people, which potentially puts us in a vulnerable position. So on the one hand, we are protected from the slings and arrows of other people seeing through to our emotional lives, but on the other hand, we may in fact cease to have an emotional life.
But it's so interesting how far politicians, male politicians especially, I think, more than female, get on their smiles. Bill Clinton got to office on his smile, mm-hmm. right?
Did Jimmy Carter.
Obama.
Yes.
Obama has a wonderful smile.
Who was the last dour president we have? I don't know. I don't remember that picture.
So Coolidge. That's one of the theories of is that he there was a headline at one point that says Coolidge smiles with exclamation points.
I want to thank you all.
Dick Cheney's smile is very, that's probably the smile of our age.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That is not a real smile.
Half a smile is better than none. I want to thank all of you for being on this program today. Marianne LaFrance is a professor of psychology at Yale and is the author of Why Smile? The Science Behind Facial Expressions. Dave McKenna is a writer based in Washington, D.C., and Priscilla Wald is a professor of English and Women's Studies at Duke University. Thank you all for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which, as you know, is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.